This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Next speaker is going to be Dr. Marta Wozinska, who is the Senior Fellow at the Center of Health Policy at the Brookings Institution. Many of you might have noticed that there have been increased issues with scarcity of everything from IV fluids to infant formula. Some of that might be related to the pandemic, supply chain issues. Some of that might be financial incentives not lining up with the needs of patients in a for-profit medical arena. Some of it might be trade policies. I'm not sure, but we have an expert who's here to illuminate us on why we're experiencing this stuff that I, as a clinician, never experienced before in caring for my patients. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here. So let me share my slides. I am going to talk about ADHD medications and the shortage, but I wanted to first give you a broader context. So let me just sort of walk you through the agenda. Well, first, a disclosure those are just my views, not that of Brookings Institution, its employees or trustees, and I have no conflicts to disclose. So what I will spend probably most of my time discussing is a general framework of why we see drug shortages. And I will talk about a number of different type shortages and how they come about. I will do a specific deep dive into the ADHD drug shortage. It's a very unique drug shortage in that what is driving it, or rather what is preventing it from being resolved, is very different than what we're seeing in other shortages. I will also touch on compounding a little bit. One reason is that compounding can be a way to resolve some drug shortages, probably less so for ADHD medications. But I also understand that many of you who are on this webinar do use compounded products for your patients. And so I wanted to talk briefly about how compounding, oversight of compounding, is different than of manufacturing of drugs. Okay, so let's talk about a big picture of how drug shortages come about. Shortages happen when there is either a supply shock or a demand shock, and then simply the supply chains cannot absorb it. It's as simple as that. So what kinds of shocks are we talking about? Again, it could be demand shocks or supply shocks. A major demand shock that we're all familiar with was COVID-19. COVID-19 caused demand to skyrocket for masks, for ventilator drugs, for all sorts of protective equipment. And then later on for vaccines, there was clearly a shortage of vaccines. So a good example of a demand shortage. Another one is actually GLP-1s. This is not really an increase in prevalence of a condition, but more sort of discovering and different use for the drug for an existing condition. The government prepares for what are called CBRN threats. Those are the chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear threats. So that is something that the government anticipates that we might, in a case of attack, there's a part of the federal government that specifically prepares for those, and the national stockpile is actually meant to help alleviate potential shortages in the case of a demand spike. And then also another thing that you see is that shortages will frequently travel from one to another. So if you have, if you were to see a shortage of one drug in the therapeutic class, this, for example, happened with both ADHD medications and also with GLP-1s, the demand for one product then sort of spills over to other products in the class. ADHD drugs actually fit in this category. There has been, and I'll talk a little bit about this more later, there has been an increase in the number of patients prescribed these drugs, and simply the markets have not been able to adjust to this increase in demand, and I'll explain why. We also have supply side shocks. Manufacturing quality is a common one, and I'll show you some statistics on it soon. Manufacturing quality is when manufacturer has issues with the product. They have to stop production to either not necessarily that machinery breaks, but that they find that there's a problem in the process and they have to go and address that process. So for example, they might find that they didn't clean properly between batches of products, that there might be some other problem. They're finding bacteria in their product where there shouldn't be any. So then they have to figure out where it's coming from. So these kinds of disruptions can cause a disruption in production and then create a shortage again if the shock is large enough and it and the system cannot absorb it. Discontinuations are not a common reason for shortages, but we have had cases where a manufacturer exits the market and they have a large enough market share that it causes a problem. There was a manufacturer in the United States, Acorn. They actually were the sole manufacturer of some very specialized products. And then when they exited, there was nobody else to replace them. So that they actually went bankrupt in that case. Natural disasters, several very prominent examples, two of them with saline, Hurricane Helene most recently hitting the Baxter facility, and then in 2017, also a Baxter facility, Hurricane Maria hitting a facility in Puerto Rico. Also, Pfizer was hit last year, around this time of year, by a tornado, and didn't actually result in shortages, but we could have easily had shortages after that. Here's an interesting piece. We hear a lot about our exposure to China with our supply chains. Here, we hear a lot about geopolitical risks. And we heard a lot about potential export bans during, not just potential, but actual export bans during COVID-19. However, when you look at the last 20 years since the data have been tracked by both FDA and also University of Utah, ASHP, there are no examples that are known examples of an export ban actually causing a shortage. So shortages have in the past have been largely driven by everything that I've listed so far, except for export bans. But moving forward, I think there is a real concern that it could be a very real reason for shortages. So it's more of a potential a shortage cause. So moving on, what I mean by potentiators are things that affect the size of the shock relative to the size of the market. Because again, you know, if the shock is very small, you don't even have to have very strong buffers in your supply chain to be able to absorb it, right? So the size of the shock really matters. And some shocks are, you can't control the size of a hurricane, but some of the factors, the relative size of the shock to a large extent is driven by how the market is organized and structured. So not the size of the hurricane, but the fact that Baxter's facility made, that one facility made 60% of saline for the entire 1 liter bags for the entire US market. So, and the same thing about Puerto Rico, if you have facilities co-located, or for that matter, that has implications for also geopolitical risk, right? If facilities are co-located, they're more likely to be subject to a common shock. Therefore, the potential size of the relative shock is larger. If the market is very concentrated, you also have the potential for this shock to be much larger if a given facility, just like the Baxter facility, is responsible for a very large share of the market. What also matters, what can precipitate a shortage before we're buffering doesn't matter all that much, is around stockpiling. And stockpiling is a little bit of a dirty word, in that nobody says that they stockpile or hoard. They say, I'm just trying to proactively buy some product before the hoarders get here. In reality, what's happening is that when there's a signal of a potential disruption, you see buyers, and it's less patients. Patients can't go and stockpile their medication as easily because it won't be covered by insurance. But there are far fewer restrictions for hospitals to stockpile their product. And when you look at what's happening, it's happening a lot. So for example, it only took 24 hours for wholesalers to put drugs on the allocation after the tornado that hit Pfizer's facility. In those 24 hours, hospitals placed orders. I mean, they were placing orders across the board on anything where Pfizer was in the market, whether or not they didn't know whether Pfizer was making the product at that facility. For one product that was even not made in that facility, product orders went up in those 24 hours by 1,000%. What we also have seen, and I've actually seen data from when the carboplatin and cisplatin shortage happened in 23, is that hospitals, large hospital systems in particular, which are much more sophisticated, they have buyers that are committed to this, to monitoring supply chains. Those larger, more sophisticated hospitals went from having a couple of weeks of carboplatin and cisplatin in their inventory to sitting on 6 months stockpiles of that, when smaller hospitals and clinics basically were looking around as where's all the product, we can't find it. So this kind of stockpiling or panic buying can really exacerbate the shortage. It puts so much more pressure on manufacturers and wholesalers to basically prevent this from happening so that the shortage is not precipitated as much, and so that there's actually also more equitable distribution of products in the market. So the last piece is, so we have a shock, let's say 20% of production, 50% of production disappears. The question is, what happens next? Do we have excess capacity? Well, actually, maybe I should start with inventory practices. To what extent do we have buffer inventory for the products? Typically, we don't have much. Typically, hospitals and pharmacies and whatnot, it's very much just in time. Not much inventory is being carried. Manufacturers don't necessarily have excess capacity for them to be able to ramp up their production, especially when it comes to generic manufacturers, because their margins are so low that having high utilization of their facilities is really, really important. So there's not much excess capacity. Even if you had excess capacity, they are frequently limited in their ability to flip from one product to another. So you cannot make a cytotoxic drug on a line that doesn't make cytotoxic products. You cannot actually, to make antibiotics, you frequently, like penicillin, you actually have to have a separate building. It's not just a matter of switching from one product to another. If you want to make 250 milliliter saline, you have to have a line that will make 250 milliliter saline. Your line might not be able to make 1 liter bags because your machinery does not make 1 liter bags. So there's potentially, even if you have excess capacity, the ability to pivot from one product to another can be very limited And it's particularly true for a lot of the sterile injectable products. The fungibility is much greater for oral dose generics. The buffers on the coordination systems and allocation systems, I would describe less that it helps you prevent a shortage or come back from a shortage faster. This is more about minimizing the harm in the system. Making sure that the product is distributed to patients that needed most, where the product is needed most. If you think about COVID-19, and for example, monoclonal antibodies, it was handled by the state. So the federal government would give it to the states. And then the states, many states actually try to identify ways to figure out what would be sort of the most reasonable way to share the limited monoclonal antibodies across different facilities. Okay, so this is the big picture. Again, if there is a large enough shock relative to the size of the market, and there aren't enough buffers, we end up with a shortage. So one thing that I wanted to sort of flag is that pharmaceutical supply chains are quite complex, and there are many possible nodes that can disrupt them. So, we tend to think of the final product manufacturer as the drug manufacturing, and then distribution, and then the point of care, sort of getting it everywhere. The upstream supply chains are quite complex. So you have the active pharmaceutical ingredient, which, by the way, can have multiple inputs made by yet other manufacturers. But even if you look at, injectable penicillin, or actually, let's do oral penicillin. For a typical tablet, perhaps only 10%, 5%, or even less is the active ingredient. The rest of it are excipients. And those excipients are inactive in that they don't have a therapeutic effect, but they're incredibly important in making sure that the product behaves as intended, that it dissolves, that it's stable, that it dissolves at a particular rate, that actually some of them just provide bulk. And they're not easy to substitute with each other. And there's between 3 to 10 of them. Each one of them comes from a different manufacturer. Each one of them is then made by a number of other manufacturers, sort of the ingredients come from there. Then you also have packaging, like the vial itself and the caps and whatnot. And I think if there was one lesson learned from COVID is that frequently the sort of the lowest margin piece in all these pieces was where actually problems would occur. Something was missing. This one very basic thing would be missing. And then and not just one supply chain would falter, but a number of them across the board. This picture is much more relevant actually for thinking about geopolitical risks than current shortages. And let me tell you why. So here's a picture here's some FDA data showing how much what is sort of driving drug shortages. And the quality issues that I've described are really the primary reason. Now, this is only for a certain number of years, but quality issues always top this list. Here you have unknown, but the other ones, increase in demand, natural disasters, product discontinuations. I don't have here sort of problems with ingredients, upstream ingredients. I don't have it on this list, but those sort of vary over time. We've actually had more shortages driven by increase in demand recently, but usually it's quality issues in the sterile injectable, in the finished dosage market. So let me just tell you. So here's a breakdown. Again, this is from specifically January of 23, but this picture is the sort of the order consistent over the years. The drugs that are listed by FDA on its drug shortage list tend to be primarily generic sterile injectable drugs, followed by other generics, and then by brands. The brands right now actually are largely GLP-1s, actually. This is actually probably an unusually large number because of GLP-1s. And you can see the kinds of drugs that have been in shortage. And a lot of them are really, really basic things like bacteriostatic water for injection, or morphine, or epinephrine, or calcium gluconate, oxytocin. It's kind of bread and butter for inpatient care. So let me talk a little bit about the geopolitical exposure, and then I want to make sure that I have enough time to jump over to talk about ADHD. Where drugs come from, so most of the drugs that we take, not we pay for, but most of the drugs that we take are generics. We pay for brands, but we take generics. 92% of all the prescriptions in mail and retail pharmacies are for generics. Talking to hospitals, generics probably make up 80% of all the volume dispensed of products, of the number of units dispensed in a hospital. So very heavily generic. So here's a picture of where generics are made. Actually, I think what is surprising for a lot of people is the India part is not surprising for all of those products. I think this is what we know and understand. A lot of the generic sterile injectables are made in the United States, something that I think a lot of people don't realize. Also, what is not, might be a surprise to you here, is that China is actually not as big of a player when it comes to finished dosage form products. Frankly, they're actually not even as big of a player in active ingredients, except for certain markets. I actually don't have the data, but I've heard frequently cited that they're a big player with in the antibiotic space. Where China really is very important is going back to really, sorry, the very left-hand side on material suppliers, the inputs to API, the key starting materials to excipients, some of the excipients themselves, probably packaging. That's where probably we have a lot of exposure to China. So just this is basically the point that I was trying to make. U.S. manufacturing is much more significant with finished dosage drugs, not just for generic sterile injectables, but primarily significantly with brands as well. The more upstream you move, the more foreign production there is. Although on API, while it might seem a lot of it is from Europe, actually, not from some of a lot of it is from India, but a lot of it is from Europe, probably not most. But as we move up, when I showed you on the very left-hand side, all the excipients and raw materials, we don't know where it comes from, but in talking to people in industry, they say that we have a very strong reliance on China. Okay, so now let's spend a few minutes talking about ADHD. So the quick history, that particular shortage began with Adderall being listed on the FDA drug shortage list in October 2022. That followed a steep increase in prescribing, especially among those aged 22 to 44. Eventually, the shortage spilled over to other ADHD medications. All these drugs are still in shortage more than 2 years later. And the question is why? So what's different about these products than a lot of other products where shortages have lasted for a long time is that these are oral dose products. Oral dose products don't face the kind of production complexities where it's really difficult to shift production from one product to another, where it's really difficult to ramp up production. That is not what's going on here. What is really going on here is that the drug enforcement aid, that they're scheduled to drugs, and the drug enforcement agency tightly controls how much manufacturers can make. And it happens on two levels. One is that the drug enforcement agency determines what should be the aggregate level of quota for a particular active ingredient. And DEA has not been increasing quota in line with prescribing. DEA then also assigns manufacturers their quota, the specific manufacturers. So they take that number and then they divide it among manufacturers. What they largely consider is historical production rather than things like reliability of their supply chain. So we have had a case where one manufacturer received a large market share of a product, then they had a production disruption, and DEA would not issue quota to anyone else because that would bump into their aggregate quota. So there was a scramble because simply nobody, even if whoever wanted to produce more products, they were not allowed. When it comes to aggregate quota, part of the challenge is that FDA doesn't have good data to be able to advise DEA of what is the actual demand for these products. And so FDA uses sales data from IQVIA, which is constrained by the quota. So if you look at sales data and if the quota are binding, then all you're going to see is the level of quota rather than the actual demand in which should be probably better measured by prescriptions or maybe by diagnoses. I will mention also that Lisdex had another problem last year in, I think it was last year in August. I don't remember whether that was in 23 or 24, but Vyvanse went generic. And there were probably about 14 different generic applicants that requested quota and basically didn't get it. So we ended up in a situation where normally the brand dramatically, really fast, loses market share as generics come in on the market, which is really important because frequently when a product goes generic, payers, so insurers, will basically say, we will no longer pay for the brand. You have to buy a generic version now. The problem is that there was no generic really available. I think by the end of the year, there were only 2% of the market share was actually for generic versions of Vyvanse. So the question is, where do we go next? So one, I would say, upside is that we're going to get a new DEA administrator. And the reason why I'm saying is an upside is because the past administrator did not really seem particularly interested in drug supply chain resilience and was basically characterizing the ADHD drug shortage as not a real medical concern, but more of a, this is another opioid epidemic, and so we're not going to enable it in any way. But we have a new HHS secretary who has said, who is not necessarily very supportive of ADHD as treatment. And also, we have this executive order from February 13th. And let me actually quote what the order says. It first lists a number of statistics around how Americans are not healthy and how lifespan has been shrinking. And then it says, these health burdens have continued to increase alongside the increased prescription of medication. For example, in the case of ADHD, over 3.4 million children are now on medication for the disorder, up from 3.2 million a couple of years ago. And the number of children being diagnosed with this condition continues to rise. This poses a dire threat to the American people and our way of life. And so this executive order establishes a MAHA commission that is going to, among other things, look at prescribing of ADHD medication to children. I don't think just children, but there's a big focus on whether prescribing to children is appropriate. Okay, the last thing that I wanted to briefly touch on, and since we're basically out of time, if this is an area that you're interested, I would recommend you go on the Brookings website and look for my name and look up this, you see the picture there, an explainer on how compounded drugs, how FDA oversees manufacturing, the drug manufacturing of generics and branded drugs, and how this compares to compounded drugs. So I'll probably stop here. There are some really important differences that you might be aware of. So anyway, I will leave this as an aside, as something you can read more about if you're interested. So with that, I will switch to Q&A.
Well, thank you so much. That was incredibly illuminating. I really appreciate your insights and especially reading the ADHD directive. That was very illuminating. One question we have is, can you explain why several home care patients I know were suddenly unable to obtain portable kangaroo bags and pumps several months ago? It was especially difficult on patients who could only tolerate 35 cc's an hour of fluid, and the families were told to just use gravity bags.
I don't know. This is too much in the weeds. You would have to talk to... Where I would refer you to is ASHP website. They track all shortages and they try to the extent that information is available, they will provide information about what is causing a particular shortage. So I would refer you to that resource. The data is compiled by University of Utah, but it's on the ASHP website.
But I'm sort of still sort of processing all of the complex pathways for medications to be manufactured. And I'm wondering, you know, a lot of this is sort of outside of many of our daily activities as providers and as patients. And I'm wondering, you know, maybe advocacy is a sort of a key step to help to address this. And if so, what type of advocacy or where would be the right lever that we should be focusing on?
So I would say that there's sort of two places. One is within your organization. If you are in a large health system, you should be asking questions of your leaders about how they make their purchasing decisions. Is this all just based on price? Are you actually carrying higher inventory? How are you sort of in working with, you know, what does the procurement system look like? What ends up happening is that there's a tendency to just have everything just in time. And then when there's a problem, it ends up on the backs of providers who then have to run around and figure out, you know, sort of workarounds for patients, and on the backs of the patients who then are not getting the right type of treatment. So I think it's really important for providers to be engaging in conversations internally about how, what are you, the CEO or the CFO or whoever sort of, you know, who runs the pharmacy procurement, how are you making your decisions to assure that we have a reliable supply of drugs? So that would be one. The other one is really advocacy with lawmakers. I will say, you know, the carboplatin and cisplatin shortage really landed hard with Congress, and there were a number of hearings. There were a number of legislative proposals passed. I don't think a single bill was passed. Part of this is that shortage got resolved and things calmed down. And, you know, we don't have people basically screaming at the top of their lungs. It's like, this is a problem. But let me tell you, this is not going away. It's just a matter of time before shortages happen of that kind. This is not the first time we have had cancer shortages and not the last time. This is not the first time we have had saline shortages and not the last time. The way I look at this is I continue having engagement with policymakers and I continue to develop proposals. So when there's going to be another crisis, because there's going to be one, there's going to be a set of proposals that are basically ready to turn on and turn to. One thing that I would recommend, though, I will say, one thing that I have seen in the provider community is that they tend to embrace solutions that sound good, which are not necessarily the solutions that will actually address the problem. And so I would recommend that anybody who gets involved in advocacy get really educated, really about the economics of it, because what's driving all of this is economics. And it's really important that anyone who engages in advocacy around it really understand the economic incentives that are at play, because otherwise they will end up supporting policy solutions that will either be wasteful or ineffective, and it just muddles the conversation. So that, I guess that would be sort of an ask from me for those who are going to engage, is that they really get educated about the economic factors that are involved in this.
And when you say economics, and sort of follow-up question, do insurance companies and the you know, the pharmaceuticals, not the companies, but I think the management systems, do they come into play as well?
Absolutely. So how the government structures its payment very much incentivizes hospitals to buy the cheapest, right? So some of this is that, you know, you have DRG rates, that you have single J codes for ASP for generics. So that's part of it. The way GPO contracts are structured also, right? It's all about buying the cheapest. So in a sense, hospitals are given a lot of such incentives. But for example, another program that I find highly problematic is the role that 340B plays in generic sterile injectable markets. It's a relatively small piece of the pie for hospitals, how much savings comes from generic sterile injectable 340B, but it makes a really big difference to a carboplatin manufacturer. It could be half of their market. And if they are going to face a tariff increase right now, 25% tariff increase, that gets passed on to 340B hospitals. Great for those hospitals, not so great for the manufacturer, who will be just like, you know what? I don't want to be in this market. I can't make any money. So I know that 340B is, oh my God, it's like a third rail, but I think it's really, really important for hospitals to realize that 340B for brands is a whole different animal than 340B for hospitals. And it's actually a really problematic policy when it comes to generics.
Can you tell us what 340B is?
So 340B is a program that's run by HRSA that allows certain qualifying entities to obtain drugs at a much lower price. So they can bill the insurers at the price. They might still get the reimbursement at ASP plus 6%, let's say. It's only for outpatient drugs, but they will be able to buy them at a much lower price, which is discounted by the manufacturers. Manufacturers have to provide those discounts based on a formula that's calculated by a federal agency, an HHS. And that formula ties to Medicaid inflation rebates. So if prices increase at a higher rate than the consumer price index, then there has to be that sort of spills over. It has to be paid back in those rebates. So I am happy to provide some links explaining why that matters. I've written about it a bit, about why this is going to create problems with some of the reforms. It doesn't align with some of the reforms, for example, that Senate Finance has proposed, and it will create a lot of problems potentially when it comes to any tariffs, were they to move forward.
Wow, sounds like complicated, but I'm glad that you're working on it. And there is a question from the audience about what is a best case scenario for resolving the ADHD shortage?
Get involved in the Maha Commission.
Not specific, but basically, what these are real patients who are having difficulty procuring supplies for for themselves or their children.
What I would say, this is going to be a policy issue, a big policy issue. I think one is to speak out, but also providing evidence. So if anybody is doing research, doing research papers on the impact that this has or the importance of the, not only of the medical benefits, but impact on the children's well-being, the fact that it doesn't create harm, creating evidence and putting forward that evidence is going to be really critical.
Well, this is very illuminating. What one just final thing is, if we want to be effective advocates, is there an organization that has action alerts so that we can support or that does know what's effective? Is there some organization or something that has their finger on this that we could?
Yeah, so perhaps there is a group called End Drug Shortages Alliance that might be a good place. It's a group of stakeholders in which GPOs and manufacturers and various health systems participate. So I think perhaps that organization. I'll have to think what other ones there are. I will put in a link. So I am just about to launch a website that organizes all the work that I've done in this space, and I have a lot of work. But you could just simply go on the Brookings website, type in my name. You don't even have to remember my last name because I think I'm the only Marta. So if you can remember my first name and Brookings, you'll find me and you'll see all of my papers there. I have a paper that I'm working on explaining the impact that tariffs might have on drug supply chains. So I think that will be a useful paper. I will put in the chat probably sort of the high-level explainer and my take on the various policy proposals that have been put forward. I think that will be a good overview for a number of folks.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.